Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to take an adventure with rugged capability and commanding style. Check out the Honda Ridgeline, Pilot, Passport, or CRV. For a limited time, well-qualified buyers can get a 1.99% APR on a 2025 Ridgeline or a 3.99% APR on a 2025 Pilot, 2026 Passport, or 2025 CRV.
See dealer for financing details.
A History of Love and Hate in 21 Statues is the title of a new book by Peter Hughes, talking about statues standing as markers of collective memories, connecting a shared sense of belonging. They have been somewhat of a hot topic in the news over the past 2 years or so. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, Peter Hughes. Peter, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you with us. Statues, I mean, they used to be things that you looked at occasionally. Perhaps you put a traffic cone on one's head. We wouldn't give them two sort of glasses in the 70s, 80s and 90s, but that's all changed recently.
I think that's right. And at various times in history, those things that sit reasonably benignly or unnoticed in the background of our lives suddenly come to the fore. And obviously for us over the last, particularly the last 18 months to 2 years, and especially since the killing of George Floyd, statues have really become a hot topic because statues really are all about identity. They stand there as symbols of what we stand for, what we believe in, who we are as a society. And when that sense of collective identity becomes contended, it becomes contentious, then statues obviously are the first thing in the firing line. And then there are those who protect them because they think that they want to preserve the tradition, they want to preserve the dignity of the past with all its flaws. And there are those who want to tear them down and say, no, the past is inherently evil and we need to tear these statues down and replace them with new ones. Or as Gary Young from The Guardian suggested, have absolutely no statues at all, tear the whole lot down.
But I mean, the thing is, you could argue, I suppose, that if people can't get at the people or the institutions that they want to protest against, a statue, especially recently, is perhaps the easiest to vent your spleen, to make your protest. Obviously, I'm thinking about the events, for example, in Bristol a couple of months ago.
Yeah, I think the thing with statues is, you're right, I mean, people can use them as, if you want, a vicarious form of activism where they can't attack the institutions or they can't attack the politicians they want or they can't tear down the structures they want to tear down, so they pick on the statues. And statues really are reasonably good for that because they have faces, they have bodies, they're almost recognisably, well, they are recognisably human. But the one in Bristol, when you talk about Edward Colston, really, the statue of Edward Colston in Bristol is a particularly interesting case because there was a documentary made recently on the BBC about the tearing down of this statue and a dilemma faced by Marvin Rees, who was the black mayor of Bristol. And at the time the Edward Colston statue was torn down and obviously it was thrown in the harbour, his job really was to try and keep peace within the city because suddenly it began to fracture, not just along political lines, but along racial lines and along different identity groups. And in one really quite remarkable interview, he said, I've got white middle-class activists on the lawn outside my window at the mayor's office telling me, a black man, that I ought to apologize for slavery. He said, well, how's that going to work? And he's quite right. He said it's more complicated than that. And what we lose once people divide themselves into identity groups, you know, one thing is good, one thing is evil. And once they become polarized in that way, then dialogue becomes difficult, if not impossible, and violence inevitably ensues. And the book really covers 3,500 years of history where really the tearing down of statues is often closely allied with the killing of people.
I was going to say, isn't it quite interesting that, you know, I never knew there were so many historical fans out there in Bristol who would know the history of the slavery movement in and out, etc. As you see when people put, you know, deface the statue of Winston Churchill, for example.
Well, Churchill was another one. I mean, they put, I think they wrote they would have torn it down had they been able to, but they put Winston Churchill, the one facing the Houses of Parliament, they put was a racist. And you know, that's because they suddenly make out of a very complex individual who is obviously, like the rest of us, a very flawed human being, but also a quite tremendous and brilliant human being, and taking all the nuance out of a life and saying, well, he's either good or he's evil, he's either all good or he's all evil. And because of his personal political affiliations and personal history, said, no, we'll put him in the evil box. And human beings are more complex than that. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr., it's one thing I quote in the book, famously said, there's some good in the worst of us, there's some evil in the best of us. And actually, once you begin to see that, then you can become truly compassionate. Because what these the social justice warriors on either side of the political divide really do is they, by stripping nuance away from historical figures and from present-day living figures who associate themselves one way or the other with these historical figures, they become very cruel because they sit down and say, well, because of this, therefore I am consigning you to the dustbin of history. I'm designating you as evil. Human beings are more complex than that. And another statue I discuss in the book is the statue of the Frederick Douglass, who was taken down in 2020 in Rochester in New York, and nobody knows who did it. It could have been, he was just for those who don't know, Frederick Douglass was born in 1818. He was born into slavery. He was a black American. He escaped in 1838 and became one of the leading abolitionists, an orator, and the first African-American to be appointed as a U.S. Marshal. And he believed in the United States Constitution. In a very famous article he wrote, a speech he gave called What to a Slave is the 4th of July, he said, look, the U.S. Constitution, he said, despite all the sins and flaws of the United States, the United States Constitution is something that we can actually believe in. So when his statue was taken down, people weren't sure who did it. It could have been people on the anti-racist left who tore it down because he believed in the U.S. Constitution, or it could have been white supremacists on the right who tore it down in revenge for the tearing down of Confederate statues throughout mainly the southern states of America.
It's interesting.
So these situations are complex.
It's interesting you bring up the southern states of America, because the whole Confederate statue debate, yeah, which raised, and, you know, presidents were getting involved and people were defending them, and, you know, there was this whole groundswell of, you know, basically the South rising again, if you like. But like it or lump it, that is this serves as the defining moment of 19th century America. And perhaps you can say it's not the same as having a statue of a Hitler, for example, on, you know, in Germany, which you can understand why they take that sort of down, or a Mussolini in Italy. But you know, it's much more, as you said before, much more complex than just taking down statues of Robert E. Lee, for example, or any other Confederate general.
It's interesting because this is really a fascinating one. The Confederate monuments are interesting because most Confederate monuments, the American Civil War started in 1861. The Confederacy was defeated in 1865. But most of the Confederate monuments, in fact, the peak years of building Confederate monuments were between 1910 and 1920. And that's because at the South, at that point, Reconstruction had ended, and segregation and Jim Crow laws in the United States, in the Southern states, were in force, and discrimination was rampant. There were maybe two to three lynchings of African Americans happening every week. Some of them at the base of Confederate monuments. These monuments have a complex and bloody history, as it were. But the issue is, what the monuments were there to do was to try and rewrite history, really, because and to say this isn't about defending slavery, it's not about defending Southern values, it's more about just saying that Southern values, our heritage, is what we're defending. It's nothing to do with hate. And they had this phrase, heritage, not hate. And they also had the phrase, the lost cause. It become kind of reviving this lost cause of decent Christian Southern values. And but of course, again, it's more complex than that. And famously, one of the Confederate monuments taken down, the one I talk about in the book, was in Portsmouth, Virginia. And as with a lot of Confederate monuments, they had four Confederate soldiers at the base. And in a mirror, really, of the killings and brutality the human beings do to one another, the statues were beheaded, and they were to great fanfare. And this is something that has been carried on throughout the Deep South of America. Mitch Landrieu in New Orleans said, look, he removed a Confederate monument in 2017. And he said, we've got to stop celebrating, he said, a fictionalized, sanitized Confederacy. But the problem is, whether we like it or not, in making very strong and overt gestures and that are against the values, the beliefs, or the culture or the heritage of an entire group of people who do not wish to reconstruct slavery, bring it back to life or anything like that. We have to bring them with us. The danger of doing this and the danger of splitting into warring identity groups is we create more radicalism on the right and we create more radicalism on the left. We have to find a more humane and more conciliatory way of doing it. And South Africa points in this direction. At the end of apartheid, they had to decide, what do you do with all these racist statues? What do you do with them? And the solution they came to was an interesting one, because there were two camps, basically. One camp said, no, apartheid's at an end. We need to celebrate that triumph by bringing every one of these statues to the ground. Mandela said, no, he said, mirroring what Martin Luther King said. He said, what we think is good, some people think is evil. What we think is evil, some people think is good. We have to find compromise, and that's what they did. So they took down the most egregious of the statues, left the others standing, reinterpreted some of them, put other statues close by to challenge the narrative of those statues, and it worked. As one politician at the time said, you don't heal old wounds by making new ones. And that's so true.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because history, like all lump, it is a messy, brutal business with old wounds. I mean, I'm speaking to you from Spain, you know, and Spain went through the Civil War, and we had the Pact of Forgetting after that, which was trying to put the democracy through. But if you sanitize history, if you take out the bits that you don't like or did not fit your narrative, then surely you run the danger of people not learning from history, because they're only learning from their own particular views and they won't understand the nuances. We've had examples where, for example, the Taliban in Afghanistan tried to obliterate history because it wasn't to their liking.
Absolutely. Well, if you look at the Taliban in Afghanistan, another statue I talk about in the book are the Buddhas of Bamiyan, which were blown up, if you remember, in 2001, in March 2001, shortly before, a few months before the attack on the Twin Towers. And what was extraordinary about that is that the Taliban conscripted Shiite Hazara Muslims who had to carry explosives on their backs. They had to clamber up around these giant statues. I mean, these statues were just absolutely enormous, some of the biggest statues that have ever been built. And they had to clamber to the top of these statues, bore holes into the bodies of the Buddha, put the explosives in. And eventually, of course, the Taliban blew the Buddhas up and in the process slaughtered nine cows as a celebration. And that was really a symbol of them saying, you know, that our identity, our values are going to triumph and we're going to pay no heed to what the international community thinks. So interestingly, last month when the Taliban came back into power, what did they do? They took down another statue. The first thing they did was they took down the statue of a Hazara leader who they'd tortured and executed in 1995. And after the Taliban had been defeated in 2001, this statue was put up and now it's gone down again. So statues are really battlegrounds. And what we need to learn is tolerance. And there are those who say, for instance, going back to the issue of the Confederate monuments, well, by all means, let's preserve the history, but let's put it in a museum. But this has to be done through a process of negotiation, through a process of enforced... Sorry.
I was going to say, absolutely. But I mean, in the former Soviet republics, for example, in the Warsaw Pact nations, they have, and I've talked about this before, these rather melancholic sort of statue parks where statues of Lenin and Stalin have been left to basically be taken over rather splendidly by nature.
Yeah, and that happens. There are statue cemeteries, if you want, throughout the world. I talk about a statue graveyard in New Delhi, which have got the great British imperial statues in them, and they're all being, you know, overgrown with weeds and plants and shrubs and that, of course, is the fate of all history. But and every empire falls. Every great figure eventually, you know, dies. The legacy changes. The interpretation of what that figure did changes, and history moves on. What matters for us now in the present that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. At a time where we've got illiberalism, particularly in the West and particularly in the United States, illiberalism on the right and illiberalism on the left. And when that illiberalism is spreading like a virus really through our societies, we can't afford to stoke it. We have to be realistic about where we are. And dialogue between opposing factions is becoming increasingly difficult. The United States, of course, being the case in point here, where the bipartisanship, say, to some degree of the 60s and 70s has vanished, has completely disappeared. The cross-party consensus between Democrats and Republicans is close to zero, and you can't have a functioning democracy. For us in the West, who have grown up with values of pluralism, due process, free speech, none of this can exist without the consent of the people. And the consent of the people depends on the fact that we accept liberalism as the basic underpinning values and principle, liberal principles as the underpinning values of our society. If we don't do that, then we are going to collapse. And there's a statue I talk about in the book, Statue of Confucius, which was taken down in 1966 in Khufu in China. And it was extraordinary. It was taken down by Red Guards, largely by students from elite universities, took the statue down, dragged it through the streets with a dunce's cap on its head, and threw it onto a burning fire. But at the same time as that was happening, bodies of the Confucius' ancestors were dug up and hung from trees. Around the same time, students at elite schools started humiliating, parading their teachers and lecturers through the streets with placards around their necks, saying what they'd done wrong. And of course, the killings soon followed. I mean, the first, I think, was a vice principal of an elite Beijing girls' school was clubbed to death with a nailed spike and a body thrown in a garbage can. So it's not far. Once you go down this illiberal route, it's not far before the killing of people follows, which is why the Chinese Alliance, the Citizens Alliance of Chinese Americans in Greater New York, did an open letter saying we have to stop this. The more elderly members of that group said we came to America to get away from the Cultural Revolution, and we can see what is happening here, and we're repeating the processes. We're repeating the same structures. We're repeating the same illiberalism, and we have to protect ourselves on that. And of course, on the right, you've then got your QAnon conspiracy theories, your Trumpian election conspiracies, and these extremes feed off each other. And those of us who sit in the center ground who are looking to preserve the values of liberal democracy are getting pulled by these giant magnets on either side of the political spectrum, one on the left, one on the right. And eventually the center will collapse.
Looking from, like, if you like, the political no man's land, as we do, at the left and the right, you could argue easily that statues are an easy target. They're a flashpoint. And in a world where we no longer have considered political debate, but we do it for a tweet, for a like, for a headline, we have lost the art of discussion, of informed, intelligent debate, and therefore a flashpoint like a statue is an easy one to provoke before we rush off to the next big cause. Because what we've seen in the past 5-10 years is we don't debate. We have these massive arguments. We have these massive sound bites. It is all over the news, you know, famous for 15 minutes, if you like, and then we move on to the next big topic.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Social media, you know, Facebook with its likes and Twitter with its retweets and the social media platforms have made an enormous contribution to this, because to the point where extraordinarily Essex University last week came out and said that they felt it was appropriate that maybe instead of always doing books as part of decolonizing the curriculum, we could study tweets. and we could study short form blogs, and this is the really the dumbing down of education. But what's behind that, of course, is a profound need we have as human beings to belong. You know, we are tribal creatures. You know, you take 20 kids and they're all mates, and give 10 of them a red shirt and 10 of them a blue shirt and tell them to play a game against each other, suddenly they instantly understand the rules of that game. They know what's expected of them, and they forge immediate and quite deep alliances with members of their own team. And the triumph, really, of liberal democracies is it controls those instincts. And what we're now seeing, and social media is playing a huge part in this, is the collapse of that consensus, and people saying, no, we're now going to go back into our tribes, as if that's going to provide us a solution for anything. And in the book, I talk about, this is a chapter on the destruction of the statue of Cecil Rhodes, I talk about a paper which was, fascinating paper, which was done in a psychology journal last year, which showed that those people who see themselves as virtuous victims, those people who do a lot of virtue signaling, also score very high on what we call dark triad personality traits. They tend to be Machiavellian, which means very manipulative. They tend to be psychopathic, feeling they can take without feeling they have to give anything back to the society of which they're a part. And they also tend to be very narcissistic, with a grandiose sense of their own purpose and grandiose self-regard. And those traits are extremely corrosive, really, for engaging in a dialogue with anybody. Because when I say, I know who I am because I stand against you, and the you that I stand against happens to be anybody who disagrees with any of the beliefs that I have, and I am refusing to debate you, then we're really opening the gates to hell here. And we may look at it now and think, well, we're over-exaggerating it. But always remember this. In 1928, in the Weimar Republic, the National Socialist Party got, was it 2.8% of the vote. 5 years later, Germany was a one-party state. I've already mentioned the Cultural Revolution in China. We saw what happened with Bolshevism after 1917. And we go all the way through the history that I talk about here. We are repeating those patterns. We're repeating the ideological patterns, we're repeating the psychological patterns, and if we're not careful, we'll repeat the history.
You say that the statues may also hold the key for our future. How do you mean that?
Well, I mean, in the sense that if we keep tearing, gnawing at the fabric, the values and the pluralism, the belief in free speech, the belief in the individual before the collective, if we keep tearing away at that, which is what a lot of statue destruction is about, then it opens a future for us, which is the one I've been outlining, which is really not a very pleasant one at all. You know, it's the war of all against all, and we have to find a better way. I mean, there's a really inspirational man in the United States called Darryl Davis. I don't know if you ever heard of Darryl Davis, but he was a black musician, an African-American musician, who has, in a lockup somewhere not far from his house, more than 200 robes of Ku Klux Klan members that he persuaded them to hand over to him. And his story is really quite extraordinary, and it really holds a key of how we can negotiate our way through this morass. Because he experienced racism. When he saw his first experience of racism as a kid, he thought, how can you hate me when you don't know who I am? I'm an individual. You're just judging me by the color of my skin. And it became one of his life's missions, really, to do a way to fight this intolerance. And for an African-American to persuade 200 Klan members to hand over their robes to him. Some of these were grand wizards. They were high up in the Klan. And he did it by treating them, first of all, as human beings. He applied his own question, how can you hate me when you don't know who I am? He applied it to them, how can I hate you when I don't know who you are? So he got to know them. They got to know him. And when they both saw each other as human beings, there was no place for those robes anymore.
The book is called, sorry people, I'm going to run out of time and crash the news, as right. The saying goes. The book is called The History of Love and Hate in 21 Statues. It's been speaking to Peter Hughes, a fascinating book. Peter, if people want to find you on social media or website, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me at DrPeter_H on Twitter, and you can buy the book obviously from Amazon
and the TRE and the TRE Virtual Bookstore. I'm going to
collect the TRE Virtual Bookstore.
Thank you. The book is called A History of Love and Hate in 21 Statues. It's by Peter Hughes. Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to take an adventure with rugged capability and commanding style. Check out the Honda Ridgeline, Pilot, Passport, or CRV. For a limited time, well-qualified buyers can get a 1.99% APR on a 2025 Ridgeline or a 3.99% APR on a 2025 Pilot, 2026 Passport, or 2025 CRV.
See dealer for financing details.